Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Martin Williams, senior US correspondent for IDG News Service, founder and editor of the North Korea Tech blog and moderator for this evening's program. Today's program is part of the club's Good Lit series underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Or download our iPhone and Android app for program and schedule information and podcasts of past programs. And now it's my great pleasure to introduce today's distinguished guest, Adam Johnson, 2013 Pulitzer Prize and Commonwealth Club California Book Award recipient for his novel, The Orphan Master's Son. Adam was born in South Dakota and grew up in Arizona. I was just chatting to him beforehand and found out that he started looking at civil engineering in college and then moved on to journalism. Adam, of course, progressed beyond journalism to creative writing. I stayed in journalism, and Adam is the one with the Pulitzer Prize, so you could make your own decisions about who chose right there. I'm sure you know some of his other books, Emporium, which is a short story collection, and his novel Parasites Like Us, which also won a California Book Award in 2013. Adam lives in San Francisco with three children. He's been married to his wife five times. We'll ask you about the sixth time a little later because there's something special about that. But without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming tonight's special guest, Adam Johnson. Adam, let's start off with this civil engineering and journalism start that you had. What led you down those paths and then eventually into the writing that you're doing these days?
I think I became fascinated with engineering because I worked industrial construction for several years after high school. My mother was a single mom. She was a doctor starting her own practice. And to keep me out of trouble, she would stick me in classes after school and in the summer. And I remember when I went to register for my senior year of high school, they said, "You're already done." I remember walking home alone on what was to be my first day of senior year. And I went and started working construction. I worked mid-rises in the Phoenix heat. I worked on the I-10 freeway for a year. I worked on a cryogenic plant, the Greyhound Twin Towers, the Scottsdale Hilton, the Airport Hilton, the Ritz-Carlton on 24th and Camelback. I built a mall parking lot. But how things came together, a group endeavor to collaboratively make these large projects, was quite fascinating to me. And when I went to my local college, Arizona State University, I wanted to be an engineer and make these things, despite my obvious lack of aptitude at all.
And then journalism beckoned for some reason.
Well, I fell in love with creative writing. My dear friend Craig Pike, who's the person I always turned to in college when I needed to boost my GPA, because I was taking calculus and statistics and all these tough classes, and he would say to me, "Adam, jazz appreciation." He'd say, "Adam, very sage, like the history of music." I needed these easy A's for my GPA, and finally he said, "Dude, creative writing. It's the easiest A in college." And I really had an epiphany in that class. A writer named Ron Carlson, who heads the program at Irvine right now, was a young new teacher then, and he was, electric. And all my life I'd been told I had flaws, that I was a daydreamer, a rubbernecker, a liar, an exaggerator. And they were all true, but it hurt. But when in a creative writing class, all those things, those attentions to detail, the flights of imagination, those all came together to make something that was really valued, like for the first time in life. So I majored in journalism because I thought I might be able to make a living off that. But as I mentioned to you once before, my journalism professors, after a couple of years, pulled me aside and said, "Adam, please, please, you can't keep lying in your stories." And they said, "You've got to go."
And then you ended up creative writing, a couple of a PhD as well.
Well, I mean, one of my goals was to stay in the air conditioning the rest of my life. And higher education, I have a couple master's degrees and a PhD, provided all those things. But I really did fall in love with writing. It was a true epiphany that this was the thing I was supposed to do. And I didn't care about poverty and obscurity at all. I just really loved stories. And that's what I was going to do.
So where do you gather inspiration for your stories from?
Well, I think, you know, my personal life, really, my short story collection was, you know, they were all very autobiographical stories. My first novel was kind of about the history of my family in South Dakota. And after my second book, I kind of said, you know, maybe I should try fiction. You know, maybe I should really make stuff up. And I ended up writing about North Korea, you know, far from my own personal experience.
Right. How did you decide on North Korea? Was there something you saw that triggered that? Some interest you had? It is an unusual subject for fiction. There is so little written about the country.
I began the book. I think I was working on the book for a year before I really realized it. It's that moment when you discover you're writing a novel. It's a very bad moment. It means like the next few years of your life are just screwed. But I was working on a novel that I thought was important. It was 2004. I usually read nonfiction when I write fiction. And I read The Aquariums of Pyongyang by a man named Kang Chol-hwan, who's now a politician in South Korea. And it was a memoir of his 9 years in Camp 15 in North Korea, Yodok. And I realized I didn't know anything about Korean culture or history. I didn't know anything about the Korean War, which our nation had fought, you know, beyond a TV show. I didn't know the Gulag system was up and running. And very quickly over the course, it was a good year to start reading about North Korea. Bradley K. Martin's Under the Loving Care of the Fatherly Leader had just been published. David Hawkes' The Hidden Gulag had just come online. Bruce Cummings was writing some very interesting work then. And I just devoured a dozen books very quickly. Shin Byung-hook had just made it out of North Korea, and his, you know, memoir in comic form was online that I found very penetrating. And for a year, I just became obsessed with this interesting place. And I didn't start writing until I discovered propaganda and the actual stories of defectors were coming online in, like, 2005 that I noticed.
Was it something that ended up sort of grabbing you and consuming a lot of your time? I know for me and other people that look at North Korea, it's something that when you first look at, it grabs your attention, and then it's very difficult to sort of look away, and something that continues.
Well, I will say that for a fiction writer, something that's half seen really triggers the imagination. And something you can fully know isn't something that engenders that creative process. And North Korea is a mystery-generating machine. I mean, that's what they manufacture and export to the world, is uncertainty. And so, you know, what was it like to be a human being there was something I kept grappling with. And the truth is, many of the books I was reading were about the dimensions of the economics, the military, the regime. But what was it like to be a person, to be a father? I had 3 young kids at the time. What was it like what if I was a writer born there? What would my life be like? Would I be able to write? What would I have to write? You know, this human portrait's missing, and was missing at the time. I think several books have filled it in much better now. Barbara Demick's Nothing to Envy is a book that I think of right away. But that wasn't there at the time. And when I began writing, I just wondered, could I make one average person in North Korea and feel confident about that? I turned out to make an extraordinary character, but that's just because I was obsessed with the place.
Your protagonist in the book, Park Jin-do, is an orphan. Mm-hmm. Why did you make the decision for him to be an orphan?
It's really quite, it's a matter of caprice, really. The first person I spoke to who was from the North had been an orphan, and that was his experience. and the way he talked about losing his family, about having no one to advocate for him, about just the caprice of his life and how the faith swung. And then when I started researching North Korea, I saw that Kim Jong-il, he had his main bodyguard group, and we know because one of them escaped, actually from Camp 15, then from North Korea, then from southern China, which, as you know, is increasingly the hardest of the three in that triple crown of survival to tell your story to the world. Kim Jong-il had a special group of only 200 orphans to guard him. He believed they were the toughest people, and they'd been through the toughest training. And that weird fact made me start researching orphans in the North. And while every citizen there must do 7 years of mandatory military service, it's much more difficult and much longer if you're an orphan.
Part of your research process also involved a trip to North Korea. How did that change the direction of the book or change the way you thought about the country? What did it add to your research process?
That's a good question. I had been working on the book probably for 2.5 years then. I knew the major sites I was trying to depict. And right away when I realized, oh, I was writing a story about North Korea, then I was writing something bigger about North Korea, I knew I had to get there. I applied to be a visiting scholar at Kim Il-sung University, which didn't work. And then I tried this great tactic. I invited a professor from what's basically Pyongyang Polytechnic, which was, it's Kim Jong-il's pet university. I wrote to them, and I invited one of their scholars to come to Stanford for a year, all expenses paid, to do any research they wanted. And I figured I'd tell Stanford, you know, afterward. You know, but that didn't work either. Who could resist, I thought. But eventually, you know, I met someone who helped me get there, a man who had an NGO there, who was another professor. And so I went at just the right time. I was halfway through the book, so the things I could discover I could still incorporate. And yet I knew North Korea well enough to know exactly what I wanted to see in Pyongyang. And to my problem when I was there was not showing my minders how much I knew and understood. Because when a few facts slipped out that they realized I was actually quite knowledgeable, they became very suspicious of me.
Is there any one thing that sticks out in your mind from that trip, or was it a multitude of things?
Oh, well, it's mind-bending in many ways. First of all, it's real. North Korea is real. It's a strange experience to study a place from great distance, from personal narratives, from satellite photos. And when you get there, the giant bronze statues are there. Kim Il-sung's body is glowing under red light in, you know, the Mansudae Mausoleum. So it's not just a fantasy, which it can seem like when you just study from the internet and from books and from people's stories. But when you go there, it's a good reminder of how normal the place is, that it's a place of 20-some million people who are just like us, but who happen to be trapped in a really cruel psychological experiment. But when you're there, you see families having picnics, you know, on Mansu Hill. You see lovers walking along the Taedong River. You see old people gathering at the corners, chatting. And so despite all the insanity that we see about North Korea, which is partly due to our media, they are just regular folks. That being said, I remember, you know, after I landed at the airport, Sunan Airport's just about 25 kilometers to the north, and all the roads are 100 meters wide so that they can evacuate should the Americans, you know, bomb them again. And we left indelible marks on their memory from our last bombings. But there are almost no vehicles. There are not enough vehicles in North Korea to have a stoplight yet, of course. But I remember as we were headed into the city, I was there in harvest season, and the first vehicle I saw, and I was really excited to see these vehicles from these old Soviet factories because I was writing about them. It turned out to be a giant dump truck with an open back, and it was moving from Pyongyang out to the countryside. And in the back of the truck were people, There were people in suits and in lab coats, and they were just normal citizens of Pyongyang. And they'd just been conscripted off the street to go help with the harvest. And, you know, I remember asking my minder, I really didn't know her then. I said, who are those people? Where they were going? And she said, oh, they're volunteering to help with the harvest. And, you know, I remember seeing a guy very clearly holding a briefcase. And I thought, who would take a briefcase along to pick corn? And I said to her, I said, they're volunteering? And she said, everyone must volunteer. I thought, oh, yeah. North Korea is real. You don't have a choice in this thing.
One of the things that hit me when I read the book was that there are references to, I mean, many aspects of North Korean culture. It seems some of the references, though, were put in the book without any explanation. Early on, there was a reference to Juche 85, which for someone that doesn't know anything about North Korea probably means absolutely nothing, but for someone that knows the subject very well is immediately obvious. Did you, in writing the book, did you wrestle with how much of this society you needed to explain to people and how many of these things like the volunteering for harvest actually had to be spelled out in the book for people that didn't really know the country very well?
Right, yes. This was a real dilemma for me. If you started explaining, there was no end to it. It's so different than our system that I made a decision fairly early on to explain nothing. I was going to have no exposition. And I don't tell the reader why there are tunnels under the DMC. I never offer why we're kidnapping Japanese citizens as you go along and do this, or why there are loudspeakers in your homes, or, you know... My goal was to make the reader a North Korean, and you just have to live by your wits. And I could have said, oh, the Juche calendar was based on the birth of Kim Il-sung and, you know, April 15th, 1912. You know, but that's boring. I love to read and be taken to new places, and I think, what the hell is Juche 85? What is this Juche system they're talking about? And so I think it's disorienting, but also defamiliarizing. Because by the end of the book, I believe the reader has been exposed to enough of North Korean culture that contextually you get all that stuff. And it's when you pop your head out of the book into America that that's what's defamiliarized, is our lives. That was what I really wanted.
So many of the subjects in the book are very real issues. The kidnapping of the Japanese that you just mentioned, the infiltration tunnels, the prison camps. Do you think there was any sort of danger that because this was a work of fiction, readers might not realize how real a lot of this stuff is for the 22 million people that live there?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting question. On one hand, it's a novel, and I can get away with anything, right? It's fiction. And yet it's set in a real place, and people are quite curious about this place. And so they want to measure the distance between what might be a rare look at a different way of life. But as you said, almost everything sourced from real life. Almost every single detail in the book came from some surface research of life in North Korea, whether it's someone getting their tattoo cut off, or whether it's the way they use fishing boats to get around the sanctions to do illegal trade. What's probably most fictional is the fact that one character would see all of these things and go on a tour. I think in North Korea, your life is fairly circumscribed. You don't tend to travel out of your zones without, you know, rare permission. You get assigned to your factory floor, and you're probably never leaving it. You're probably in your housing block for life. But I tried to make a character who, because of his circumstances, might be able to transcend a few things. And it was just, I'd love the Dickensian novel that looks at all levels of society. And I found every bit of it fascinating. There was no way I could write a book about North Korea without looking at the kidnappings. And the three kidnappings in the book are based on real ones. We had to go in a tunnel. We had to go to Pyongyang. We had to go to Wonsan. We had to get out on the sea. And so that's probably one of the bigger lies of the book, is that one character could travel and see these things. you know, we were just talking at Stanford. We saw a presentation of a person we know who runs, you know, Google North Korea. And one of the things he talked about was that, you know, people in Pyongyang are visiting his website in America because North Koreans don't know that much about North Korea. It's their country's a mystery to them as well.
When you set out to write the book, did you have any particular message you wanted to tell, or what do you consider the most important theme or message of the story?
Message in fiction. Fiction doesn't have messages in it, does it? My original goal, and the book became much bigger and more elaborate, was to just see if I could make a North Korean I believed in. And how would I know? You know? How would I know? I'll say that I feel confident about the facts in the book, right down to someone getting his tattoo cut off. You know, I had a source for that. But what do they add up to? The psychological truth of the portrait that I made is something that I can't know. I can't know it because North Koreans can't tell their own stories. They can't write their own novels. And so it's not till they're in charge of their own voice that we'll know what portrait's, you know, the right one. I started in Korean. There's a term like Hongil-dong. It means like Joe Bag of Donuts or Joe Blow. You know, like a totally anonymous guy. And I named my character that to begin with. I was like, you know, I'm not going to name this character until I feel confident enough to give this person a name. And, you know, I ended up naming him Jun-do, which is a North Korean male or Korean male name, but is a homophone for, you know, John Doe in the West, which is when you have the body but not the identity. And I really felt this was a person transcending the rules of society to define himself and to pick his own identity, and it felt oddly right.
When we started here this evening, we talked about the Pulitzer Prize and the California Book Award as well. Do you think the book is raising awareness of the situation in North Korea, and is that something that you feel happy about, something that you want to encourage?
Well, I mean, how can you not come to care about the fates of people, especially when you read their personal stories? And I encourage people to go online. There are a lot of stories, you know, of North Koreans. These stories are mostly coming from people who are working in the border regions, southern China, across the Yalu and Tumen rivers, people in NGOs, aid workers. Missionaries are some of the people on the front lines doing a lot of, you know, brave interdiction of people who are crossing. In South Korea, there's a facility called Hanawon where the North Koreans go when they make it there, and there's a lot of narratives coming out of that place. But, you know, when you... people put their stories in your hands, they're much heavier than you think they would be. And when you read a few of them, when you read a dozen of them, when you read about people who struggled in the famine, people who have truly arduous lives in rural North Korea, and I think lives are much different in the rural provinces like North Hamgyong, for example, rather than Pyongyang. And you hear about, you know, I remember I read one of the early stories I read was of a young woman, and she talked about the day she realized she was starving, you know, and it's hunger was so normal that, you know, her family was out scavenging, and it was her parents and an aunt and an uncle, and they found a rotted pear that had fallen to the ground. And they got the pear, and the father very carefully cut it into four slices. And there were five of them. And she didn't get one. And she said, you know, she turned to her father, she said, "Oh my God, we're starving, aren't we?" You know, when you hear stories like that, especially people who've seen the gulags, people who've seen the famine, and the chances ordinary people make when they escape, they leave an indelible mark upon you. And I don't know if I set out to raise awareness, though I came to care a great deal. And while early on I thought there seemed to be almost no books about the human dimension in North Korea, since my book has won an award, I've realized that more people were also writing about North Korea because editors are sending me books. Suddenly they're wondering if these books aren't also commercially viable. And I realized that other people out in the world were doing similar work. And so, not to belabor this, but I think in America our portrait of North Korea has been pretty limited. And it's seen as a place, based on the portraits we receive, of madness, of evil, or buffoonery. And it's not that at all. It's millions of people just like us, trapped under a very strange and very cruel regime. And our media just doesn't seem to have time to make those human portraits.
Millions of people that don't have any choice in it.
Absolutely.
On the subject of media, in the last year or so, AP's opened a bureau in Pyongyang.
Yes.
Reuters TV has had a bureau there for a little while. And now cell phones are starting to penetrate North Korea as well. I think that's probably one of the biggest changes since you and I last went there would be the number of cell phones that people see. A lot's changing in the last few years. This is a question that asks you to make some predictions, but how long do you think the lid can hold on North Korea?
The lid. First of all, I want to ask people, how many cell phones do you think are in Pyongyang? 10? 800,000? Yeah. We have the expert right here, Martin.
Latest number is 2 million.
2 million.
In a country of 22, 23 million people.
Yes, but these are almost all concentrated in a corridor around Pyongyang and some of the major thoroughfares. And so you've got to think that if there's, and we don't know exact numbers of how many people are in Pyongyang province, but if you know, it's like 4 million, we're talking about you take out children, I mean, and family phones, I think the saturation might not be that much different than America, honestly. You know, it's a guess, but very high saturation there. So when I went there in 2007, I saw the cell phone towers. And you know, I'm sure you had the same experience. You know, they hide them like trees, just like they do with the cell phone towers by your Costco. And so I knew what they were. And you know, I said to my minder, I was like, that's a cell phone tower. Where are the cell phones? And she said, oh, that's not a cell phone tower. And I said, there's one in my Trader Joe parking lot. I know what a cell phone tower is. She said, oh, no. But so there were people using these things in secret, hiding. And it just made me wonder, do you go in your basement? Do you have to go in a room? Are you in a hallway? Can you use them at night? How are people communicating and when? And now it's completely open. So I guess the question is, how long can the lid be upon it? There's the lid on North Korea, probably. I'm taking this question to be internal, probably.
I would say that if you think of, you know, North Korea, there's probably rules for how your life lives if you live right along the border region. And there's definitely a set of rules for Pyongyang. But if you're a majority of the people living in the vast center of the country, your life is quite circumscribed, as I mentioned. If you live in Pyongyang, you have good songbun, which is your family loyalty rating. You have real education instead of indoctrination. You have a chance to go to university. You have health care for what it's worth. You have some electricity every day. You probably have a job in the government bureaucracy that's maybe rewarding in some way. There's maybe even a chance to advance and to make your own way through the bureaucracy and rise through the system. You get to go see operas, you know, Sea of Blood, things like that. But, you know, if you live in more rural areas, and we know that the farther you live from Pyongyang, the more dangerous your life is. The harder, it's probably more mountainous, it's probably more rugged. It's more difficult to receive food. There's commodity scarcity, whether it's tools or shoes or clothing. Fuels is a real problem. And, you know, we build a portrait of North Korea based on the stories people bring with them when they leave. And Barbara Demick was just at Stanford, and she was talking about writing her book. And she wrote her book about people who left Chongjin, which is in North Hamgyong province, which is this far as you can get from Pyongyang in North Korea. It's up by Vladivostok. And two-thirds of all defectors come from this single province because life is so hard. And it's difficult there, so you have to do things like illegally cross the border, you have to barter, you have to scavenge, you have to steal, all things that are going to put your whole family in jeopardy. And that's where people defect from. And that was the source of the people for you know, her portrait. And I don't feel like I'm an expert on North Korea. I feel like anyone who spent like 6 years of their free time studying North Korea would know what I know, probably. But it does seem to me that there are two North Koreas. The people in Pyongyang have life relatively good. They know what it's like to be a peasant, because when you're there, the peasants are being bussed in all the time to be indoctrinated and to bow before the statues and to go to the museums. So I got to see thousands of people from rural North Korea, and you see the weather on their skin. You see their teeth, right? Even though they're dressed in their best clothing, you see they have very hard lives, and people in Pyongyang know this. And so the point is that people in Pyongyang don't tend to defect. And they don't bring their stories out. It's quite a mystery what it's like there, actually. Whereas so many people defect from the countryside, a couple thousand usually every year, that we have a good portrait of their lives, how much work they do, what their indoctrination's like, how many calories they get per day. My sense is that since Pyongyang's opening up, since they have iPads and cell phones, some people have 3G internet, that the two North Koreas are becoming farther apart, which is happening in our country and other countries. The haves have more and the have-nots have less. And in terms of opening the lid, I think Kim Jong-un must allow the elites in Pyongyang to have better lives, to keep control of them. But the people in the countryside are going to have it worse and worse and worse to control them. That's my sense of it.
The question came from someone that says that they were in the DPRK in 2006 and 2009. I'm just interested to know, are there many people in the audience tonight that have had a chance to go to North Korea?
Two, three?
Just a few people. 2 feet. just two or three people. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, and our guest is Adam Johnson, winner of the 2013 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction, who's discussing his award-winning novel, The Orphan Master's Son. You can find video of Commonwealth Club programs online at Fora TV. Adam, one of the things we mentioned earlier was the propaganda that comes out of North Korea. You are an expert in creative writing. What do you make of the propaganda that comes out of North Korea?
I think it's fascinating. It's unfortunately very boring and very mind-numbing. I remember when I first started reading... you can go read propaganda for yourself. The North Koreans translate all the works of Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung and Juche theory into the major languages of the world to be downloaded to your Kindle on PDF form for free. They're really interested in propagating their notions to the world, and they believe that we are all downloading these things and hailing Song-gun policy. But they also, have been putting their daily news up there, just like any... I mean, they want to be urbane and cosmopolitan and to be seen as worldly and international. And this is what other countries do. So the Rodong Sinmun has come down. I don't know why that website has come down. I really kind of loved watching the... reading the Workers' Party paper website. They had a blog of the Dear Leader's daily activities, and you could see Kim Jong-un touring mushroom factories and, KPA units and things. But the kcna.co.jp is kind of like their AP website. It has all their headlines nationally up every morning. And I'll admit, when I first started looking at that website, all the stories were bizarre. It seemed like half of the news was about 60 years old. It didn't seem to matter to them that a headline was 50 years old. Strange stories advocating, seaweed harvesting, boasting of bizarre technical feats. And I came to understand that the North Koreans don't have a sense of how the countries of the world are regarded. And so to them, France and Somalia are just two countries of the world, and they don't understand the essence of those nations. So a front page news story can be, Charles Mugabe sends a basket of flowers to the dear leader. And, you know, we think of this as, that would be a bad thing, you know, to get a gift from Charles Taylor. But I don't think the citizens of North Korea know that. And so, you know, extolling great relations with Burma, with Zimbabwe, with Cuba, with all the pariah nations of the world. But, you know, as you kind of get used to propaganda, you can see through that surface and really see the emotionality behind how they depict themselves. And what was interesting to me as a writer is this notion that in the West, in America especially, we are all see ourselves as the central characters in our own stories, right? Your life is about you. And you love your mom, right? And you're the person you're married to, but it's about you. You're the central character in your life. And each one of us, all 300 million of us, it's our story. And as such, we have a shape to our stories. We're expected to decide what we want out of life, what our goals are, what we desire. We look inward into the past and to others, and we try to imagine a best possible future self, and we go down a road toward becoming that person, and we engage in obstacles and conflict, and we have plot point one and plot point two, and we grow and change, and we end up a wise, better person. You know, this is the American story. But what was interesting to me and what I learned through propaganda is that the North Korean story is quite different, that, you know, you're a secondary character in a national story. That is one character. That's the dear leader. And it's not about you at all. It's about glorifying the regime and the human at the center of that, who's now Kim Jong-un. And you don't pick your path in life. People come into your schools and they ascertain your aptitudes. And they send you down a path. You're going to make uniforms forever. Or you're going to be a fisherman. Or you're going to be a ballerina. And what you want is actually a hindrance toward your proper performing of that role. Communication, you know, is dangerous. You end up going down a very narrow path that has nothing to do with you. And you don't grow and change and become your best possible self in any way. And that made me question the American story a great deal. But it was a shape that propaganda taught me that I wanted to put into the book.
That also came out multiple times in the book, where characters were faced with the possibility of doing something like defecting but didn't, because it was sentencing their friends or their family to almost certain death as well.
That's right.
So that's a much weightier thing to, you know, when you think about the good of the group or society, that's, when it gets down to that level, that's a very weighty thing to have on your shoulders.
It's very true. I mean, I think we hail defectors as people who risk their lives to define themselves and to reach freedom, which is true. But the people who pay the price are the people they have left behind. And I don't think we think about what it's like to cross a border like that forever, to never see your family again, to never see your friends again, to lose every landmark in your life and everything you know, and to be in that level of exile. It's very difficult for people and hard to imagine.
Has the book been translated into Korean? And if so, what's the feedback?
Well, it's being translated now, so that'll be wonderful. I can, you know, I mean, you know, for the radio listeners, I'm not Korean. So, you know, it was very difficult for me to write outside my own experience, outside my own culture, and to write in a paradigm that few people can know. And, you know, one of the things I found is that, you know, the North Koreans who get out, not only do they have survivor's guilt for having made it out of a system and having other people pay for that freedom, they're deeply traumatized by aspects of their lives. And they've also been trained their whole lives not to communicate. I think it's, you know, when you read their stories, they're often very flat. like the, either the emotion or like big events are missing, or they're broken into little pieces and have some very strange structures to them. So that I would say that, you know, again, puts a great charge upon you when you read those stories.
And that's translation being known as South Korea.
In South Korea, yes. So, I mean, I guess I forgot the question and drifted away. But, you know, this was a dimension of just coming from a culture. Every nuance, every subtlety, every inflection that I would have grown up with and would have been a part of me, I had to try to mimic and research and, you know, bug all my Korean-American friends about and until they were like, enough, enough. I was, dude, I was born in Santa Barbara, not Seoul, you know, and I have one friend from Seoul and I really leaned on her and she was like, dude, I don't know anything about North Korea, you know. So it was very hard for me to bring that specific culture to it. But hopefully when it appears in South Korea, I'll get lots of feedback.
Have you had any feedback from North Korea?
You know, they don't tend to, you know, send many telegrams.
The book hasn't been reviewed in the Rodong Shimbun newspaper? Or?
Well, I mean, it's a mysterious place. And sometimes I wonder, they do seem very preoccupied with how they're perceived by the world. You can tell by lots of their news stories and the facade of their nation. And yet they've got lots of big problems. And one day I'll think, wow, they must be aware of a portrait of them that's getting this, you know, notice. But then I think, what do they care what some dude in California thinks? You know, and I have no way of knowing.
Another question we have here. One of my favorite characters is the interrogator with the blind parents who distrust their son. Is this character based on any research that you've done?
Well, I started the book in Chongjin, which is probably the place we know most about in North Korea because the most people have left there and brought their stories with. And the book slowly moves toward Pyongyang, where the portraits are more rare and was much more challenging. So I gave myself a few years to be able to depict Pyongyang. I mean, the people who have knowledge about the regime, who've made it out, are in the dozens, really, a couple dozens. I leaned very heavily on a couple real-life figures who made it out. I went and interviewed Kim Jong-il's personal chef, Kenji Fujimoto, you know, six times, and he lived with Kim Jong-il for 11 years. I should tell my Dennis Rodman story at some point. But, you know, Choi Eun-hee was a South Korean actress that Kim Jong-il kidnapped, and the story of her life was, you know, really important to me. You know, she said when she was an actress in the South, and she'd made 60 movies, she said, you only had to act when they pointed the camera at you. But she said in the North, you had to act every moment of your life. And that made a big impact on me. But, you know, we don't really know anything about the North Korean Secret Service, at least that I have access to. It's called the Bowaboo. But I called it the Poobyok because I didn't feel close enough to that segment to actually give it the right name. I'm not aware of anyone from the intelligence program there who's defected, whose story is available. And it was a black hole, actually. What I did is I took, you know, another Asian genocide on its people, the Cambodian genocide, which they documented very closely in Phnom Penh. And I took the story of one of their state interrogators from the Tuol Slang prison, and I moved his story to Pyongyang. But the essence of that story about becoming paranoid and policing your family members, I think is very common in the North. Because the two big prisons, 14 and 15, and they're consolidating many of their Kwanli So camps into making them even bigger, these are family camps. And if you commit an infraction against the state, your whole family goes away with you. And so what this does is it makes this action of any have full familial repercussions. And that's how terror is transferred from the regime to the individuals through the family. And so the grandmother will say to someone in the family, oh, hey, you didn't bow deeply enough today. You know, people notice. Or the uncle will say, oh, don't talk to so-and-so. I'm not sure about him. but the way people start policing each other for mutual survival and the way paranoia can seep into the family is something I really wanted to depict with that character.
Compared to North Koreans in the capital, the freedom that foreigners have when they visit is complete. But one of the things that we do feel as visitors is the constant presence of the minders that mm-hmm. follow us around, the tourist guides. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about your minder and how truthful or untruthful you believe he or she was?
Oh, well, it's impossible to know. It's impossible to know. I went with a group of four, and I went with a professor that I knew who kind of cultivated his resources to get me in. He knew I was writing this book. He said, nobody's writing a book about North Korea like this. He had an NGO there. He had great ties with the North Koreans. And he kind of risked his relationships to get me there. But he was a known figure. And wherever we would go, like the director of that factory would come out. And we'd be like, the eyes were off of me a little bit. I was like his sidekick. And they seemed to have no idea that I was a writer, though they could have Googled me. And they would have seen that I taught writing at Stanford and that I had published books and articles. But did they? Didn't they? Do they care? I think they think their tour is so managed that you could find nothing that reflected poorly upon them is their overconfidence. But we had a main minder. She had her assistant minder who was straight out of the academy. He kind of dressed with a black tie and was still practicing all the routines he'd been taught. And he would say to me, what do you think of terrorism? There were lots of long bus rides, as you know. And you'd be like, I think terrorism is bad. He would say, let me tell you what Kim Jong-il thinks of terrorism. And then he would have memorized a half-hour speech to deliver. That happened constantly. Our main minder, she was very urbane. She was very sophisticated, perfect American idiom, great sense of humor, very educated. She was everything but worldly. She had everything but a sense of the world. And she was fantastic. When I showed too much interest in a place, oh, it's closed. Because there were places I wanted to get to. And they were very excited when I showed interest in, like, the Revolutionary Martyrs Cemetery. But there were a couple of things I was depicting that I wanted to get to that she just refused. She just did not trust my intentions. And I wrote some scenes out of the book because I didn't feel confident in the surface level of them. I remember she took us to the great statue of, you know, Kim Il-sung that now has Kim Jong-il beside him. And in that square, you have to buy flowers and bow and all this stuff. There was a storm drain lid, like a sewer lid, had this beautiful Cholima horse depicted on it with all this Korean writing. And it was the most beautiful sewer lid I'd ever seen. And I was like, man, no one would make a sewer lid like that in America. And so I was supposed, like, this was like Jerusalem to her. This was the Wailing Wall I was at. And I was asking her to translate this sewer lid for me. She was as baffled as any human could ever be. And I asked her, you know, where were the fire stations? You know, she said, oh, we haven't had a fire in 12 years, she told me. And I just asked all these simple, where were the old people? Where were the handicapped people? You know, and the last straw. And, of course, because we were Americans, the minder of the minders, the director of the KITC, kept coming into mind of them. And it was clear that their lives depended on how well our trip went, you know. The worst outcome would be to negatively affect anyone's life there in our visit. But I remember when I was there, all the women had the same lipstick. It was like one North Korean shade of lipstick, and all the women had it. And I just had to know the name of it. Was it Scarlet or Magnolia or what was it? And when I asked her, this hard look on her face, you know. It was the only time her guard came down. And you could see that she knew that women in other places in the world did not have to wear the same lipstick. And it was a moment of great shame for her. And she just kind of glowered at me. And I could tell that was the one that hurt. That was one she'd never practiced. So, but bright, wonderful, interesting people. And I will never... I felt like we had human moments often, but I can't know.
That's, I think, one of the most unusual things about being there is you never really know what's real and what isn't. And your natural assumption is to assume that a lot of what you're seeing isn't real, but probably in reality, a lot of it is.
Yeah. I mean, you can't talk to a North Korean while you're there. It's the one place in the world you cannot speak to a North Korean is in North Korea, because it's illegal. And it's a crime, and they could be in serious trouble to just be suspected of interacting with a foreigner. So you only talk to people who've been to college, who have a university degree in handling you. And they're very good at it. And you just don't know. And they don't defect. Do we have a minder who's defected to your knowledge?
No.
That would be so valuable.
Three questions here, all fairly similar. What's next for you? Do you hope to write more about North Korea? And has winning the Pulitzer Prize changed anything?
What's next? Let's see. Let me answer the questions. No, I'm not writing fiction about North Korea at all. I mean, I set out to make a portrait, and I ended up feeling really good about it. I don't know if it's right. I honestly don't know. But if based on what I encountered, what I studied, what I know of North Korea, it felt true. And of course, that's limited and unknown. But I've written a couple nonfiction pieces because I feel like there's a little unfinished business. And the genre of nonfiction, even though I'm a proven bad journalist, matters to me. And you know, my standards of journalism have changed a great deal over the years. I think I'm going to write a couple more nonfiction pieces. I'm writing completely different fiction. I have a story out in the current Esquire magazine about a coder in Silicon Valley who can reanimate the dead and bring them back to life. There's lots of sex in it too, and I'm writing a novel now that's much different. Has nothing to do with North Korea. Has winning the Pulitzer changed me? You know, my wife and I still don't quite know exactly what it means to have that, but my wife and I talk about it. We both liked our lives before. We have three wonderful kids. I'm very fortunate to teach at Stanford with great students. It's rewarding. We live in one of the great cities of America. It's difficult to live here, but I don't want anything to change.
You mentioned your wife, and I alluded to this in the introduction. I understand the sixth time you married her, you shot each other in the heart with guns.
Yes, we did.
Tell us about that. They weren't big
guns, but they were Olympic 22 target match pistols, a nice matching set. They were really glistening. And, we were, 15 paces apart, and, we had our bulletproof vests on. But, there's that great, if you really love someone, I advocate it completely. Because you just have to, bare your chest and have that shaky, love-filled hand lifted to your torso, and then it happens. And I don't know if anyone's been shot while wearing a bulletproof vest. There's this smell that comes off when the hot round kind of penetrates into that black nylon, and there's that little snake of tangy, melted nylon smell that comes up that you'll never forget. We were in the desert in Nevada. You're married when that happens.
And you probably know you're in Nevada, too. I'm not sure how to follow that, but another question. What's your favorite part of being a professor at Stanford? And you can't say the weather.
Oh, God, the weather's unbelievable down in Palo Alto. No, the students are just so amazing. I find writing really, really draining. But teaching just energizes me. I need both of them in my lives. One just recharges my batteries. And The students are fantastic. I love teaching. I've taught in Louisiana and in Florida to college students there. And I like teaching in California. The students are ravenous and hungry. They're in creative writing classes because they want to be, or because they want easy A's. I don't know. They're just hungry and talented. And it's easy to write by instinct, but when you have to explain it and dissect it, when you have to really speak to why narrative matters and how it's functioning, its totality of effect, how it's working on many levels and is organic, it keeps you engaged with narrative every day.
What advice do you have for young novelists who may not know how to get started these days?
Oh, you pick up a pen. Yeah, get to work. Yeah. What are you waiting for? An invitation? A telegram from Pyongyang saying we need your work? I'm a big believer in labor over talent. Often my most talented students are the ones that can walk in and dazzle everyone, and they're the ones that don't quite progress as much as other people who really want it. I look back at my old work, and I don't see that much aptitude or talent in it. But I loved writing stories, and I did it all day and all night. And I think you just put in your 10,000 hours.
What do you think of the state of creative writing these days, especially with the internet and blogging and all these new outlets that people have these days? Is that improving things? Are things getting worse?
Well, this is your question because you didn't read it off a piece of paper, Martin. So I can tell you're thinking about getting an MFA. Even though you're a famous journalist. I think letters are alive and well in America. There's so many people who want to be writers, who are reading books, who are making fascinating work. It's appearing in, the genres are shifting every day. Work's appearing in all kinds of new formats. You know, I'm very optimistic about, and there's something, I think the American novel's alive and well, yeah.
I hope this one doesn't put you on the spot too much. Someone's asked, is there a particular passage in the book that means a great deal to you, and would you mind reading it for us?
I don't have a copy of the book in front of me, and I don't I actually love the propaganda voice a great deal. You know.
Right.
About sharks and movie stars and the greatest nation in the world. When you think about North Korea, it's easy to kind of, if you look at like the last millennium of their history, it's been a tough 1,000 years for the Korean Peninsula. If you look at the last century, especially for the North, the Japanese invade in 1910. They utterly subjugate through occupation the Korean Peninsula. They make the language illegal, the art illegal. They totally disconnect these people from their heritage and from their voice. For 35 years, exporting 800,000 male slaves to the mainland in Japan, comfort women, just totally destroying their society. Then there's World War II. Then there's partition by the superpowers. Then there's the Korean War, which is a war that America has not come to terms with in any way. And then in the North, evil totalitarian regime for 60 years, three generations. Almost no one's alive who remembers before. But my point is, before was war. And before that was the breakdown of their culture. They haven't had a voice, in a century. They haven't been able to articulate who they've been for thousands of years, for a century. When you think about the propaganda, one thing comes really clear is that the North sees the South as an occupied territory. They see the fact that, the peninsula has been occupied by Japan and Mongolia and China back and forth for time immemorial, and they see the South. They see 30,000 U.S. troops there. They see our nuclear submarines and our fleets in dock, and the North sees itself as free for 60 years. And that weird pride of self-determination, even though this is what they've made of it, is something that I found fascinating in the propaganda. Did I get out of reading?
I think you did.
Okay.
I think you'd already finished the book when Kim Jong-il died, right?
That's right, yes.
Would that have changed anything, do you think? Or now, if you'd come to write this book now, after a couple of years of Kim Jong-un being in power, would there be much different in the book?
I don't think so. Kim Jong-il was quite a fascinating character. His entire life, from his early boyhood all the way on, is a really gripping reading. You know, when Saddam Hussein died, you know, when Gaddafi fell, you know, these regimes toppled. And the people went into their palaces. They went into the torture chambers, right? They went into the bureaucracies and opened the files and read their secret records. They were demystifying experiences. And, you know, it was so great in Libya to see, like, average citizens sitting in Gaddafi's golden tub, getting their pictures taken with cell phones. But when Kim Jong-il died, the mystery only intensified. And we learned absolutely nothing about that place. So I don't think the transfer of power has changed any of the depiction of that I would have done.
I think we're unfortunately reaching the point where we're almost at the last question. I wish we could have got to all of these, but I think we'll finish with your Dennis Rodman story.
Oh, it's a long story.
That's right. We've got 2 or 3 minutes.
Oh, I would just say that, you know, I interviewed Kenji Fujimoto, who was Kim Jong-il's chef for many years. Kim Jong-il trusted his Japanese sushi chef because he was an outsider, because he had no ties to the regime. He didn't speak the language. He trusted Fujimoto not to poison him every day. And Kim Jong-il, they tried to kill him a few times. And he was a very paranoid man. Rightfully so. He became paranoid when he took power in 94 that, you know, people were going to kill his kids especially. But on his ascension, the paranoia worsened. And one day he just fired all the nannies. He told Kenji Fujimoto that he was now the kid's playmate. And every morning his Japanese sushi chef would have to take care of the boys, Kim Jong-un, starting at 7, and his older brother Kim Jong-chol, who was 9. And the sushi chef, who made it out, took care of the boys every morning for 11 years. And he told Kim Jong-il, hey, if I'm going to take care of these boys, I need a video game. Kids in Japan have video games. He said, hey, kids in Japan have roller skates. So Kim Jong-il got roller skates and video games and a water slide. And Fujimoto said, hey, kids in Japan play basketball. And if I'm going to take care of them, I'm going to teach them basketball. So they got the dimensions of a basketball court. Kim Jong-il had one built at all 17 of the main palaces, the guest houses. And Kim Jong-un was ravenous from a little boy for basketball, and they played every morning. But Fujimoto's problem was that the kids had never seen basketball. He was teaching them the game cold. They'd not been to a game. They'd never seen anyone else play it. So Fujimoto wrote to his sister in Japan, and he said, you must send me video of people playing basketball. And she videotaped the Bulls' 1990 championship run, in which the Chicago Bulls become the world champions, and she sent these tapes to him. And so Kim Jong-un, as a young boy, loving basketball, his first footage of it was of Dennis Rodman, of Kim Jong-il, of Scottie Pippen and of Michael Jordan, of these three being the ultimate superheroes, the best basketball players in the world. And so it's easy to think from our side of it being really weird for Dennis Rodman to go there. But for this young boy who really loved this sushi chef, who had this first exposure to the West through Dennis Rodman, it was a very godlike power to bring his hero around the world to his knees.
Fascinating. Thank you. Our thanks to Adam Johnson, 2013 Pulitzer Prize and Commonwealth Club California Book Award recipient, for his novel, The Orphan Master's Son. We also thank our audiences here in San Francisco and on radio, television, and the Internet. Today's program has been part of the club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. We want to remind everyone that copies of Adam's novel, The Orphan Master's Son, are on sale in the lobby, and he'll be pleased to sign them. just right outside this room as soon as the program is finished. We also appreciate your allowing him to make his way to the signing table as quickly as possible. I'm Martin Williams, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.